This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. It's time for another Bits and Pieces episode. Lots of aviation topics, including the New England Air Museum, the VMA 311 Squadron of AV-8B Harrier Jets, the C-17 Globemaster III, the passing of a moonwalking astronaut, the commemorative Air Force's Tora Tora Tora, flying the pits cross-country, an across-the-pond segment, a good airline story, and learning to fly. It's all coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 505 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. The Memorial Day holiday in the U.S. corresponds to our usual recording day, so as is the tradition, we have a Bits and Pieces episode for you. Before we get started, I just want to take the opportunity to direct you to the aviation calendar at avgeekfests.com. This is a service we run where you'll find many aviation-related events that people who are passionate about aviation will enjoy. And if you are aware of any events you'd like to share with the community, feel free to submit them right at avgeekfests.com. That's avgeekfests.com. All right, let's get started. On May 20th, Drone Mama and I visited the New England Air Museum to listen to a presentation on the history of Pratt & Whitney. This was given by Mark P. Sullivan, former director of communications for Pratt & Whitney, now retired, and author of Dependable Engines, The Story of Pratt & Whitney. After the presentation, I spoke with Mark, and then the museum's executive director, Jerry Roberts, but first my conversation with Mark. I'm here at the New England Air Museum with Mark Sullivan. He, in the past, had been the communications director with Pratt & Whitney, and Mark has just given a really sizable group of folks a little bit about the history of Pratt & Whitney. Mark, you wrote a book a few years ago. I think I actually have a signed copy myself.
Oh, good.
But what was the genesis for the book? How did that come together?
Well, there had not been a book written about Pratt & Whitney, in many years. There were a couple of books about particular engines. And the then president of Pratt & Whitney approached me and said, I had just retired after my PR career. And he said, would you be interested in doing this? And because they'd also been approached by the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics that said, gee, you know, our library, we don't have one. And would you, thereby hangs a tail. So I said, sure, I'll take a whack at it. And I started doing the research and putting it together. And they gave me a computer in an office. And I had access to a very good archive system, which they have there, and other writings and whatever. And it's fascinating. I learned a lot. And so it took me probably just shy of a year to write it all and then track down photos and that sort of thing. And it got published in 2008. So.
Yeah, that was actually the same year we started this podcast, so it'll 10 years anniversary. Wow. Yeah, yeah, it's hard to believe, isn't it? Yes, yes. So was it difficult to research the information?
No, there's a lot around. If you poke around, and of course the thing that's changed everything in this world for authors or whatever is the internet. Sure. You can find all kinds, you just have to check and make sure it's fairly accurate. But also there's a very good – Pratt & Whitney has a very good archive that's been maintained for many, many years. For those who are familiar with this place, the New England Air Museum, Harvey Lippincott, who was one of the heroes of this museum, was the archivist for United Technologies and, of course, Pratt & Whitney. And so the things were done very, very well and cataloged, and they're all there. It's just sorting through them can be difficult. But it's interesting. One of the things that Harvey did that was very interesting is – he or one of his associates did a whole bunch of interviews with very senior people at the end of their careers. Mm. So it's like I quoted today several things from Jack Horner, H. Mansfield Horner, who was the head of Pratt & Whitney and then chairman of United Aircraft. And there's a long, long interview that they did right at the end of his career. And it's talking about all the things because he was a very young man when he started.
Well, the end of the career is probably a great time to do that, not only because does the person have the experience that they went through, but they're maybe more willing to talk about some of the things at the end.
Yeah, exactly. They, you know, looking back and they with a certain amount of fondness and whatever. So I don't know. I wish, I hope it's being kept up because it's, you know, every day somebody's retiring and whatever, who's had an interesting career and done interesting things. And it's good. It's good to know those things. And you know, I hate to see anything that's lost to history. Mm,
yes, yes. Now, as I was listening to you today talk about the history of Pratt & Whitney, it struck me that there were a couple of kind of, well, maybe inflection points or points in time where the history of Pratt, what was going to happen next, was largely determined in that short period of time. Right. So maybe example, when United Aircraft was broken up, yeah, or maybe at the end of World War II when the orders suddenly went from a lot to
nothing.
You know, to nothing. Yeah. Are there some specific periods, well, inflection points in Pratt's history that sort of stand out for you?
Well, one of the things that's interesting, what you're just saying now, after I wrote the book, one of the executives who was somewhat younger and hadn't just joined the company, he said, "I read your book and I never realized, boy, there were some really tough times and there were some really, as you said, inflection points are like, you know, the road's going to part. Which way are we going to go?"
Right.
Certainly the commitment to build the first engines in 1925, build the Wasp, invest the money, go do it. And then I think you're right. The big thing was at the end of World War II, there was a company that had built hundreds of thousands of piston engines. The world is going to gas turbine jets, and they know nothing about it. And what are they going to do, and how are they going to do it, and who's going to do it, and whatever. And they did. They did by, you know, just investing, working very hard, taking a chance and jumping the competition. Jack Horner said in his memoir, they jumped the competition. They said, you know, we're just not going to match. We've got to come up with a completely different and better engine. And that's very much, you know, the thing that they've done. I think very recently at Pratt & Whitney's history, this new commercial engine, the geared turbofan, is a big, another, you know, I mean, they have sold now, I believe it's 8,000 of them, because it's so much more efficient than anything else on the market. So, you know, the phrase that they use are, you know, it's a game changer. And there have been several of those, and it's risky. Again, they always say in aviation, if you're Boeing or Airbus or General Electric or Pratt & Whitney or Rolls-Royce, you're betting the company when you do one of these programs.
Exactly.
There's a couple of billion dollars at stake, so.
Now, you're a volunteer, do I understand, here at the New England Air Museum?
Yes, along with 200 and something other crazy people who come here. This is a wonderful place. People should come here more often. One of the things that people should remember is this museum runs strictly on the paid staff is 7 or 8 people. It all depends on volunteers. And it's a lot of fun, great, great bunch of people. And, you know, if you're handy, go over to the restoration hangar. You'll have the time of your life screwing around with messy old airplanes, or learn the history and be a docent or a guide here. It's a lot of fun. I enjoy it tremendously.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for spending a few minutes with our listeners. Tell us, where can we find the book? Is it on Amazon?
You can find it on Amazon, and you can also find it if you look up the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. Look in there. They have a bookstore, and they have several books. There's another book on Pratt & Whitney written by Jack Connors, another volunteer here at the museum. They published his book, too. His is much more technically oriented than mine was, so they're really complementary to each other. So, but they're both there. AIAA, and look at their bookstore.
Okay, perfect. And you provided a list of some other books that were written about the history of Pratt & Whitney, some related topics.
Yeah, the books by Bill Gunston. Graham White is a guy who wrote some books. Matt, let me just get my sheet here, and we'll go. I'll read, if you'd like, I can. There's the Engines of Pratt & Whitney by Jack Connors, the R2800 by Graham White, the R4360 by Graham White, Development of Jet and Turbine Aero Engines by Bill Gunston, Development of Piston Aero Engines by Bill Gunston, and the World Encyclopedia of Aero Engines by Bill Gunston, a fabulous British guy who passed away recently, who devoted his life to studying aviation and writing about it. And if you can find one that's interesting, if you want to know more about gas turbines, The Aircraft Gas Turbine and Its Operations by Pratt & Whitney, which can be found. And There's another one called The Pratt & Whitney Aircraft Story that was privately published by the company in 1950. So there, those are some choices if you're interested.
Great, great. Well, Mark, again, thank you. How's retirement treating you? Pretty well?
Very well. I have no. As you'll hear all the old Pratt retirees say, I never knew I could be so busy. So
that's right. I can identify with that. Okay. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. We'll put the reading list Mark mentioned in the show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/505. And New England Air Museum Executive Director Jerry Roberts is coming up shortly. But first, our Airplane Geeks reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari, has been doing a good job recording some great interviews for us. From the Central Texas Air Show, here's Major Pasquale from VMA 311. The United States Marine Corps attack squadron of AV-8B Harrier jets.
Hello, airplane geeks. Your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari, and today I'm with
Major Matt Pasquale from VMA 311, call sign Squeeze.
And you're flying the loudest airplane here at the Central Texas Air Show,
the AV-8B Harrier.
All right, and let's take a small bite out of this problem, and let's get real geeky. Let's talk about vectored thrust in air combat maneuvering. Do you practice it?
We practice it a little bit, mostly in the simulator. We get at least one training flight in it, in the operational forces, but it's very limited use, I would say. Not a lot of guys use it, except in very, you know, selective circumstances, if you will. You're kind of selling the farm as far as energy goes when you pull those nozzles in, can rate the nose around very rapidly, but you bleed energy very, very quickly, and low energy is usually not a place you want to be in the air-to-air environment.
So after you've pulled a tighter turn or pulled your nose around, your airspeed's going to be like nothing.
Yeah, we can rapidly degrade, rapidly bleed off airspeed there, so you pretty much either have to take the shot if that's what you're pulling for, or have an out so you don't get shot yourself.
Okay, so it's really not, it's in your pocket, but you don't, it's not your major tool that you're going to go use.
Yeah, it's another thing in the bag of tricks that is the Harrier, I suppose.
Let's talk about, at an air show here, the fact that you really don't have a high show and a low show because it's kind of all the same show for you, right?
Yeah, that's the Harrier has what we call the Level 3 demonstration, and it's scripted by Headquarters Marine Corps. It's dictated what the maneuvers are. We can get by with about 3,000-foot ceilings, 5 miles vis. You know, we could probably trim it down a little bit, but just with the speeds and the maneuvers we're doing, we need to have that cushion there. So that's the show. It peaks out at about 5,000 feet AGL in its standard form. But it's not overly restricted as far as, like, weather.
Well, speaking of restricted, though, we're here at Temple Airport deep in the heart of Texas, and you're not going to be able to do a vertical takeoff or a vertical landing, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So we're restricted to doing hovering over either prepared matting, AM2 matting, which is expeditionary runway matting, or more commonly concrete surfaces. Here at Temple, there's no concrete on the runway. So I'll be doing all the standard hover work at 100 feet, but if I get below 100 feet with the jet pipe temp of the exhaust, the actual air pressure coming out of the engine, it will melt and then blow holes in the runway. So,
and that would be bad for us GA pilots.
I tend to think they'd frown on the Harrier past that if we ruin their runway. It's been done at many airports before, usually not during an air show, but somebody sitting at idle with their nozzles deflected down. It can very easily melt asphalt.
Okay, that means you're going to have to do what we would consider a standard airplane landing. Talk me through that. What's the approach angle? What's the speeds? What's the flap settings?
So we'll do, in place of the vertical landing, we'll do what's called a rolling vertical landing, where we're touching down at about 60 knots ground speed. For that, for the air show, I'm going to do it from a hover. So I'll, from my nozzles effectively pointing straight down, I'll take them and then deflect them to 60 degrees and then exhale to 60 knots ground speed, about a 5-degree glide slope. The flaps at that point are basically we have a stove setting that they're tied to the nozzles, but at those air speeds, the flaps are 62 degrees down. So they're pretty well deflected, 5-degree glide slope, 60-knot ground speed, and it'll take me about, from the hover to touchdown, it's about 1,000 feet down the runway.
Talk me through the takeoff then.
So for today, I'll be doing what's called a short takeoff or a stow. So after we do our run-up checks and everything, I will stand on the brakes when I throw the throttle into the corner. Once I feel the jet skidding on the tires, I'll release the brakes. And then based on what the computer calculates as our nozzle rotation speed or NRAS, today it's probably going to be about 60 knots. So once I hit about 60 knots, I'll take the nozzles, I'll pull them down to about 60 degrees, and the aircraft will lift off the runway at that point. It should be about 60 knots indicated and about 300 to 350 feet ground roll for the takeoff.
Well, that's not bad, but 60 knots, 350 feet, that's, you're down with us little pilots then.
Yeah, but immediately after that, I'm going to suck the gear up, and I'll be at about 360 knots and about 1 mile away from my liftoff point.
And converting lots of fuel into decibels.
Yeah, absolutely. So in max blast and hover, we're burning about 230 pounds per minute. So math in public, it's a lot of gallons. In max blast, it's about 200 to 230 or 40 pounds per minute of JP5.
And real quick, as we ask everybody, how did you get here to this position in life?
Well, I did Naval ROTC at the University of Texas. And then from there in the Marine Corps, you go to the basic school where you spend about 6 months learning how to be a basic officer and infantry officer. From there, you go to basic flight school, aviation pre-flight indoctrination in Pensacola. I just had really good experiences with the instructors who were Harrier pilots, my exposure to the airplane itself, and I really liked the mission. So I put Harriers as my first choice and got lucky again, wound up selecting that. Go to the Harrier training squadron. That was about another year where you spend a significant amount of time relearning how to fly an airplane because it has one extra lever and movable jet exhaust. So that took about another year before I was in an operational unit as a new guy. So all told, from commissioning, graduation at college to commissioning and commissioning to an operational unit was just over 4 years.
All right, now, you're with VMA 311. You're a regular squadron, are you with the Harrier demo team?
No, the Harrier community doesn't have any dedicated demo teams. I'm just a regular operational fleet pilot, so that based on my experience and time in service, I got tagged to go work on my demo qualification. And then when air shows request the Marine Corps presence at them, Headquarters Marine Corps divvies up who's going, West Coast, East Coast type of airplane, and then it filters down to the individual units. So we got tasked with this. I was lucky. I was already a qualified demo guy, and going to school in the area, I jumped at the opportunity to come to this air show.
Well, thank you, Squeeze. This is Launchpad Marzari, your Airplane Geeks reporter, frequency change approved. Good day.
Learn more about the United States Marine Corps at www.marines.com. Next up, our main man, Micah, notes the passing of astronaut Alan Bean.
Al Bean. I just liked saying the name when I was a kid. It was a cool name. Sounded like he would be a cool guy. What a neat name for an astronaut, for the fourth person to ever set foot on the moon. If it weren't for that cool name, at least pretty cool to a 13-year-old boy, I might not know much about Al Bean. Unlike some other astronaut names I know that are in the forefront of my brain, Captain Bean didn't fly a lot of missions, but he sure did save the day on one of them. Turns out, Al Bean was a pretty cool guy, and one of my childhood heroes. It also turns out that I guess I'm at the age where I'm starting to lose a lot of them. Now the last survivor of Apollo 12 is gone. Born in 1932, Alan Bean was a Texas boy and a University of Texas graduate with a degree in aeronautical engineering. He was part of the Navy ROTC program there at the University of Texas, and after graduating, being commissioned, and getting through flight school, he flew the F-9F Cougar and the A-4D Skyhawk. Eventually, he was assigned to the U.S. Naval Test Pilot School at Patuxent River, where Pete Conrad was his instructor. Albin applied for Astronaut Training Group 2 and was rejected. That didn't discourage him, though. He applied and was accepted to Astronaut Group 3, along with Buzz Aldrin, Gene Cernan, Mike Collins, and 10 other names you may know. He was assigned as backup command pilot for Gemini 10, but never did fly Gemini. In fact, he never got assigned to an Apollo mission either. He ended up in the Apollo Applications Program, where he worked on the Neutral Buoyancy Simulator, and was the first astronaut in the tank to try it. He had resigned himself not to fly Apollo, when some luck struck him, both good and bad. You see, fellow Astronaut Group 3 alum and Apollo 12 Lunar Module pilot Clifton Williams was lost in the crash of his T-38. Pete Conrad, Apollo 12 commander, remembered training Albin at Patuxent River and personally requested that he become Clifton Williams' replacement. See what I mean? Good and bad luck at the same time? Albin was the right man for the job. In fact, he saved the day. You see, Apollo 12 was struck by lightning on launch, and it knocked out the telemetry. As you can imagine, quite a problem for a rocket on its way to the moon. In trying to restore telemetry, the command came from the ground, try SCE to AUX, an obscure switch that seemed to stump both Commander Pete Conrad and Command Module Pilot Richard Gordon. But Albin knew it. With Pete Conrad's hand firmly grasping the abort handle, Albin saved the mission. Pete Conrad and Albin landed the Lunar Module Intrepid on the lunar surface and did two EVAs. Turns out, mixed in with all the hard work, there was quite a bit of fun on the moon. One of the mission objectives was to collect some material from the Surveyor program, an unmanned two-year NASA mission that demonstrated the feasibility of soft landings on the moon pre-Apollo. Albin had smuggled a camera timer aboard Apollo 12 so he could take a photo of himself and Mission Commander Pete Conrad in front of the Surveyor, something that was done as a practical joke for NASA scientists as they knew nothing about the timer. But when the time came to take the picture, he couldn't find the timer, and a photo was never taken. When he did find the timer, just before boarding the lunar module for departure, he just tossed it away over his shoulder. The timer isn't the only thing Albin tossed away on the moon. He'd worn a silver astronaut pin for 6 years. As an astronaut that completed training but had not yet flown a mission, he was not entitled to a gold pin. Knowing he would be awarded his gold astronaut pin upon his return to Earth, Albin tossed a silver one into a lunar crater. There were a few other little ditties I could retell. Some Playboy Bunny photos attached to a lunar checklist, for example. But this is a family show. Albin didn't have another space mission until 1973 in Skylab 3, the second manned mission to Skylab. During that time, he spent 59 days in orbit, performed a spacewalk, and even tested a prototype of the manned maneuvering unit. It's said that his Skylab crew accomplished 150% of its pre-mission goals. Although appointed backup spacecraft commander for the U.S. crew of the Apollo-Soyuz project, he never flew in space again after Skylab. As a captain, he retired from the Navy in 1975, but stayed on with NASA for quite some time afterwards as a civilian in astronaut candidate operations, where he had the unofficial title of chief astronaut. I always felt that Albin had a heart. Like I said, I could hear it in his name. I thought he was a cool guy. Turned out, I was right. He was in line to fly some of the first space shuttle missions, but chose not to when he retired from NASA in 1981. In an unselfish gesture, he decided there were so many younger astronauts that could do that job that he gave up his opportunity to go back into space and give them a chance. For relaxation and his own personal growth, Albin took art classes. When he retired from NASA, he focused on painting, and his paintings are beautiful. He painted moonscapes, some of him and Pete Conrad on the moon, paintings of the photos he wanted to take but couldn't due to the lost timer. He incorporated real moon dust in his paintings and used some of the tools he brought back from the moon to paint them with. When asked about those paintings, he once said that if he were painting as a scientist, he would have painted in grays. But as an artist, he could add colors to the moon. He sure did. For the Airplane Geeks, here in Portland, Maine, this is your main man, Micah.
Thank you, Micah. There was a nice article in CBSNews.com. Alan Bean, astronaut who walked on the moon, dies at 86. And in the article, it says that Bean was one of only 12 men to walk on the moon, two in each of six successful lunar landing missions. He is survived by just four moonwalkers: Buzz Aldrin, lunar module pilot of Apollo 11, Dave Scott, commander of Apollo 15, Charlie Duke, lunar module pilot for Apollo 16, and geologist and former U.S. Senator Harrison Schmitt, lunar module pilot for Apollo 17, the final Apollo moon mission. Okay, now back to the New England Air Museum. I walked through the new command exhibit with Executive Director Jerry Roberts. Here's our conversation. Right now we're looking at a new exhibit. It's not open right now, but will be very shortly. Tell us about this. This is the command exhibit.
Sure. Charlie Command was just one of the great innovators. He was a contemporary of Igor Sikorsky and others. He was very innovative. He started this company right here in Connecticut, and Command continues to build helicopters. And we have some of the earliest prototypes. We have a great collection, and this exhibit will honor everything he did. And totally a true Renaissance man. Not just helicopters. He invented the Ovation guitar, one of the most revolutionary acoustic guitars that everybody in the industry uses still uses. And sure, yeah. So just that kind of a guy. So we're very excited about it, and it will be our opening ceremony will be on Wednesday, the 30th of May, and then it will be open to the public.
Fantastic. Now, there's an interesting collection of rotorcraft here. I'm particularly interested in this experimental
so this
craft.
This is the K-225. This was one of his earliest aircraft. And his thing, he actually worked for Hamilton Standard. And Hamilton Standard, as part of United Aircraft, was supporting Igor Sikorsky in his early helicopters during the war. And Charlie was actually assigned to run the rotor-powered division for Hamilton in support of Igor Sikorsky. And Charlie Command had a better idea to solve the inherent problems back then. You know, helicopters, because the pitch of the blades controls both your motional, directional flight, and then up and down hovering. And in those days, and still on most helicopters, linkages from the cockpit actually attached physically to the aft end of the blades right near the rotor hub. So you're torquing those blades while they're spinning. Command had a better idea. He invented this system, or perfected a system, called servo flaps. So aerodynamically, instead of mechanically changing the pitch of the blades, all he had to do was change the pitch of these basically ailerons, and you would fly the blade into the proper pitch. And it removed huge amounts of control force from the pilot. This is before hydraulics, of course. And also reduced vibration dramatically. And so he perfected that, and he also went with these intermeshing rotors. The reason was, back then there wasn't a lot of available power, and on a standard helicopter, you have to have a tail rotor, of course, to keep your thing from spinning. And the tail rotor sucks about 20% of your available engine power.
So now you're significant.
It is significant, so, and it gives you no thrust or lift. So now you're losing. Now you're down to 80% on your primary flying capability. So what Charlie Command realized with the intermeshing, you don't need that. All of your power is now available for the blades. And so the combination of the servo flaps and the intermeshing rotors became his trademark. We've seen films of these things flying, and it's just extraordinary what they could do. And then this led to a series of helicopters, which eventually involved in the Husky right here. And the Husky was the Air Force's primary, they called it local crash rescue, and they say local crash, meaning these would be stationed at virtually every American airbase, and including this actual one was stationed at Edwards, and this one was the plane guard for Air Force One. So if there's a crash off the end of the runway or 2 miles away or 3 miles away, this helicopter was designed to carry the equipment and the crew needed to get to the wreck immediately, to fight fire and get the crew out of the aircraft. And that's what this was for, to fly into hell and rescue a crew. And it served extensively through Vietnam. It has the highest safety record of any helicopter ever built. And it's credited with saving thousands of lives. And so we have, in a sense, one of the prototypes that launched the company. You can see the lineage between the two. They're still almost identical in what they do. And then we have this interesting, the SH-2, which is this Navy rescue helicopter. At first you say, why is this a command helicopter? It's got a standard tail rotor. But it does still have his patented servo flaps. The reason is the Navy asked for a helicopter that could fly, this is 1957, fly 200 miles out to sea, you know, through horrible conditions, land in the water if necessary, rescue 11 people, all without any external support of communication and navigation from any other source. So command, and all the helicopter companies submitted for this, command submitted two helicopters. He submitted a navalized version of the Husky, because that was his standard fare, and then he offered this, which was a total departure for him. And a Navy admiral said, well, Charlie, between you and me, which would you pick? It's your company.
Oh, yes.
He says, I would pick this one, the single rotor one. And the Navy, the admiral said, why? It's a departure. He says, here's the difference. When I was designing all of these, we were somewhat limited in power, and we didn't want to suck that 20% off for a tail rotor. Now, with these, we have turbojets. In fact, this one has twin jets on it. There's no power constraints at all. And since you needed 200 miles high-speed rescue at sea, this was the most efficient design to do that. Yet now they're rebuilding the K-Maxes. You know, they built the K-Maxes back in the 90s as a heavy lift, a small but a heavy lift helicopter, very successful, still being used in the industry for logging, for freight, for cargo, all kinds of things. And then the Marine Corps took two of them and altered them to be operating without pilots. So in Afghanistan, there are two of these functioned for 3 years where they could fly this thing into combat zones to deliver supplies for the Marines and fly them back out without ever endangering an aircrew.
Right.
And these weren't drones. These were pre-programmed. They were programmed for a flight, so no one could interfere with them. And then they stopped making them. After 12 years, a demand has resurfaced, and now they're building them again.
Oh.
Yeah. And actually, the first one just finished production this year.
Now, these craft are in nice condition. Where was the restoration done? Was that done here?
This was restored for us by command. Command totally did this for us. Great job, and they put a lot of love and effort into it.
Yes.
Oh, fantastic! This is a really nice exhibit here. The opening is going to be May 30th.
But that's for museum members. And for command employees.
Perfect.
And then I assume the next day it'll be open to the public.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Next, after looking at the new command exhibit, we walked to one of the adjacent hangars and up to the new balcony overlooking the hangar.
This was the first building built on this site back in 1981. And these were the front doors. This was the gift shop. These were our offices. There was a wall here, and you had to go this way. So in our renovation, we cut a hole through this wall. We got to take all these doors out. We built a new front end to our research library here. We built a new grand staircase here, elevators. And now people want you, why don't we take a pop up here real quick. So now you get that sort of Smithsonian view of the aircraft.
Yes.
We also have been rearranging our collection to really show off our key planes. You know, we're not the largest air museum in the world, but we certainly have one of the most unique collections. So as far as Sikorsky, we've got everything from one of the very few R-4s, you know, the Sikorsky that was flying during World War II, to his, his ultimate seaplane, the VS-44, which flew between New York and Ireland, both before, during, and after the war. And that's fully restored and in perfect condition. It's the last one of these in existence. Last four-engine transatlantic American flying boat.
Beautiful.
And there it is. We have one of his earlier seaplanes here. Many of his helicopters. We have some Doman helicopters, who is another company at the same time. We just finished restoring our DC-3. And that's restored to the markings of the very first commercial plane to land at Bradley in 1947.
Eastern Airlines,
and it had Eddie Rickenbacker on board when it landed here. And that might actually be this plane. We have not been able to find in Bradley's records the tail number of that aircraft. It only landed for an hour. But it certainly, this plane did fly for Eastern Airlines at that time in those markings. And again, our team did this all here at our restoration facility. And then we had two painters come in, and that's all hand-painted. That lettering is hand-painted on.
On that DC-3.
Yeah, everything on it is hand-painted. There's no stencils on that at all. I mean, no stick-on. You know, nowadays they would go with shrink decals, but that's all hand-done.
Beautiful.
So it's a great collection. This is going to be a great exhibition area. We designed these bays in it. We've just secured the world's largest collection of antique toy aircraft, which we'll have on display here on and off during Christmas seasons. This actually is the world's first successful human-powered helicopter, which after this exhibit's done, we're going to suspend that from the ceiling with an exhibit about how it worked. There's an amazing video that goes with it. And then this will be exhibition space, and also it's where we're going to build the New England Aerospace Hall of Fame. And this is where we're going to honor obviously, people like Igor Sikorsky, Fred Rentschler, Charlie Kaman, and then some of the great aeronauts here, Silas Brooks, Charles Hamilton. We have the same type of airplane that he flew. That Bunce Pusher in the far end there is the oldest known plane built in Connecticut that still exists, and it was built by Howard Bunce back in 1912. So, and we've got this Blériot built in 1909. We're going to hang that.
The Blériot, yeah.
So that from here you'll be able to look at several hanging aircraft. We have a great collection of Thompson Trophy winning airplanes. Just around the corner, behind the side of the flying boat, is the Laird Solution, the first plane to win the Thompson Trophy. And it's here. And these are all Pratt & Whitney powered aircraft.
Sure.
So we're very excited about our collection and about what this
collection.
New infrastructure is going to do for us.
Yeah.
Same thing in the B-29 hangar. We've now got a fully functional mezzanine with elevators there. In fact, just 2 weeks ago, we had the reunion of the bomb wing. There's still a few of them left, and we had about 40 people here. And it's great to get these guys up and seeing their plane from up above.
Yes. Control now, so during the summer, it stays nice and cool and doesn't feel like an airplane hangar.
You're good for the people attending and probably good for the aircraft as well, I would imagine.
We never pushed summer programming because, you know, we're basically in steel boxes. Now we have full climate control. We have all new LED lighting. So we're in really good shape.
How about funding for this? This is from contributors?
In every museum, funding is an ongoing challenge. It's what everybody goes through this. We were lucky in this particular case that we were able to get for this project that we've just completed, the mezzanine you're now seeing. It was about a $2 million project, which included the mezzanines, all the LED lighting, all the new HVAC system. You know, a year ago, we had these really antique radiant heat units hanging here.
Oh, yeah.
And now it's all done through its modern systems, very efficient systems. So we were able to get a bond from the state. Just under $1 million. We were able to get $250,000 from the Hartford Foundation for Public Giving. We were able to get $350,000 from UTC because we've got Otis elevators, of course, and we've got Carrier air conditioning system. So they were in for that. They're a big supporter of us in other ways, too. We do a real lot of STEM education here, which is one of our features. We bring school kids in from both Connecticut and Massachusetts. It's all accredited programs. And so one of the ways we get funding is we go to a lot of the aviation community, the manufacturers and big companies and small companies. And of course, they all want to support STEM education because we are, in reality, part of their pipeline for future engineers. You know, we need kids to come here to get inspired, to sit in a simulator like these kids are doing right over there, and maybe those kids are going to want to go into this field someday.
I think young folks, children these days are a lot different than when you and I were kids.
That's correct.
And does that represent any kind of unique challenges, or accommodate those sort of differences?
Well, in a lot of ways. First of all, when I was, I've been in the museum business for quite a while, and back in the 90s, we all loved to spend fortunes on touchscreen computer systems. We all thought that was the cat's meow. And they're great, and they impress us, because we didn't have them when we were kids, did we?
Yeah, right.
We had to stand in front of a glass case and read something, keep our mouths shut. So touchscreens are great, and we have some here, but every kid has an iPod. iPad, a Kindle, or something. You know, they've got more horsepower at home than we could, you know. So instead of trying to compete with that market, we let kids get inside of many of our airplanes. We have an education program where kids make paper helicopters and bring them up here and launch them. They shoot paper airplanes. They make straw rockets. So they're doing stuff here. They're climbing in, climbing aboard, you know, very interactive. I know that's a cliche, but it's true. And one of the things that truly sets us apart from almost everybody is that on a daily basis, we're going to let you into at least two or three aircraft. You're almost always going to get to sit in the cockpit of an F-100 that flew right here at Bradley during the Cold War. You're probably almost always going to be able to get into a Huey. And then 4 or 5 days a year, we have open cockpit days where maybe we have 8 to 10 of our aircraft open, the Coast Guard Sea Guard, and we have a number of planes that we have that people can get into, which again, sets us apart.
That's wonderful. Now, folks can learn more about the New England Air Museum at neam.org.
Right. New England Air Museum, neam.org, and you're going to learn about our exhibits. And we've got, like I said, the new command exhibit. The next thing we're going to do is we're going to do a major exhibit about the history of Bradley Airport, which is the gateway into both into the world of flight and into the history. We're going to revamp the whole Sikorsky exhibit now that we've done command. We're going to get this Sikorsky exhibit straightened out. We're going to improve our huge collection of, by the way, Pratt & Whitney and Wasp engines. We've just got one of the best collections going. So we're going to, you know, after we've rebuilt the buildings, now we're going to redo the exhibits. And then the other things that we have is we have ongoing public programs. You know, there's always something for families to do here. This week we had all veterans were free. And then we have special events. We have special events like the Open Cockpit Days. Our biggest day of the year is Space Expo, where we have an astronaut and all kinds of science-based program. We have Women Take Flight, which is phenomenal, where people can come and meet women pilots and women astronauts and women engineers. We do a car show called Jets and Vets, where we take a couple of our shiny jets outside, and then people bring their Corvettes, and that's a great tie-in. And last year we did Mustang Muster, where we brought our Mustang outside, and people brought their Mustangs here. So throughout the year, Santa Claus actually flies in here every year, you know, and that holds court in one of our helicopters. We have a great Easter egg hunt. So we have all year round, we have public programs, and it's all on our website.
That's fantastic. Very active museum. A lot of things going on here. I think we certainly would encourage anyone who's in this area in central Connecticut, Hartford, Connecticut, Springfield, Massachusetts, anything there, New York. You're not that far, 2 hours
right,
from New York.
Right. You know, a good point is that we're not down on the coast. We're not right next to Mystic Seaport, but we're basically 15 minutes north of Hartford and 12 minutes south of Springfield. We're at the airport. We're right next to the Connecticut River, so we're really in the heart of the state. So there's a lot going on.
Great location. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Well, it's air show season, and Brian has a few more recordings from the Planes of Fame air show in Chino, California. First, he talks with Chief Master Sergeant Frank Gamache from March Air Reserve Base, where they discuss the role of the C-17 Globemaster III in being a loadmaster.
Hi, this is Brian Coleman, and I'm here with Chief Master Sergeant Frank Gamache. You are with
the 452nd Contingency Response Squadron out of March Air Reserve Base, California.
So it was just a little bit of a flight down here to Planes of Fame?
Yes, it was only about a 10-minute flight. Probably took us a little longer because we did a little maneuvering coming in.
Yeah, that reminds me of the days I used to live up in the Bay Area and flew from San Jose to San Francisco, and taxi time took longer than the actual flight.
Yes, it actually did.
So as a Globemaster, what's your primary responsibility?
Primary responsibility on a C-17 Globemaster III is the loading of any cargo, whether it be vehicle cargo, whether it be passengers, and to make sure that the weight and balance of the aircraft is where it should be.
What's your primary mission?
Airlift of people, airlift of the beans and the bullets, bringing them into the fight, if there is a fight. And it seems like more so now in 2018 as we're flying a lot of contingency response, hurricane relief, earthquake relief. We do a lot of training with the Riverside Fire Department, the Rapid Deployment Team, the LA Fire Department. And it's in order so we can get people, rescue, down to wherever people may need some help.
Is it possible that you guys will be deployed to Hawaii with a recent incident with a volcano, or is that going to be left up to Hawaiian resources?
primarily the Hawaiians will do all their flying, but because of the mainland, I'm sure there's a lot of equipment and or resources that we can bring from here, fly it into Hickam Air Force Base or Hilo, which we've done a lot of training there at Hilo, the Hilo Airport, and that's the big island where they're having all this stuff. One thing with volcanoes is you don't want to fly planes anywhere near the ash. So if there's ash there, you won't be seeing us fly in.
You're not flying.
Yeah, it'll all be shipped in. But, you know, it's a 5.5-hour flight from March Air Reserve Base to Hawaii, and we could have whatever they may need.
Okay, well, Chief Master Sergeant, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate your service. Thank you so much.
No, thank you. Appreciate it.
One of the things I always liked about the C-17, of course, is it has those four Pratt & Whitney engines. Those are technically their PWF-117-PW-100 turbofans. They each produce about 40,000 pounds of thrust, and they are the military version of the PW-2000 series of engines, which, as you may recall, is one of the two engine options that was offered on the Boeing 757, the other, of course, being the Rolls-Royce RB211. So take two of those 757 engines, multiply by two, and that's what's powering the C-17. Next, Brian talks with Matt Haynes, a longtime volunteer at Planes of Fame, and listener Bill.
And I'm here with Matt Haynes. Matt, welcome back to the Airplane Geek Show. It's good to see you again at another Planes of Fame air show.
Likewise, Brian. Thanks for coming out again, and good to see you again.
Yeah, so your duties here, still working the ramp, still, like that's a bad thing, but you're working the ramp and pushing oil?
Yep, mainly cranking some oil, but then also marshalling airplanes, doing fuel. I kind of just do whatever's necessary.
Whatever anyone asks, that's what you end
up
doing?
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, so no electric pump, you have to pump all the oil by hand?
Got to pump it all by hand.
And about how many gallons do you go through here at the air show?
We go through about 150 gallons of smoke oil and roughly about 60 to 70 of 120.
That keeps them flying. And what were the two birds that just went flying by?
We got a pair of Grumman F7F Tiger Cats. One's out of Texas and the other one's based here in California.
And do you know about how many aircraft are flying over the weekend?
Ooh, that's a good question, but I think it's in the neighborhood of a lot, yeah. Close to 30.
And so how many years have you been volunteering here?
I've been doing this. This is my sixth year out here, and been volunteering at the museum for about the same time.
Good deal.
I'm fortunate to be a part of it every year.
What's next for you?
Right now, it's once these guys are done, it's intermission, so we'll have a little bit of time to relax and get prepped for, I think it's the Korea flight that's after this.
Yeah, there always seems to be something in the air here.
Yep, there certainly is. Don't miss an opportunity to get an airplane in the air.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show, and look forward to seeing you probably again next year at a next year's show.
Absolutely, Brian. Good to see you. Have fun.
Thanks.
I'm here at Planes of Fame with listener Bill. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Been a listener for a long time. Happy to be on the show and happy to meet yet another co-host.
Yeah, we were talking before. So you've met David?
Yeah, David and I grew up in the same area outside Philadelphia. So when I go back on business or to see family, I try and meet up with David for dinner. And I've run into Rob at AirVenture.
Okay.
A couple of times, seen him driving a tiny little Mini and sat through sessions with him. And I haven't run into Max, and you and I are practically neighbors here in Southern California. So on our second try to hook up and visit, we've succeeded.
Yeah, and you're down in San Diego, and you so graciously offered to take me up on a flight in the biplane, and unfortunately that didn't work out, but we will reschedule.
Yeah, that'll it didn't work out that day. So we'll get you up in the Great Lakes and show you San Diego from the air.
And what biplane is it?
So it's a 1978 Great Lakes biplane. So it's the original design came from the late 1920s. It was in competition with a bunch of other airplanes for the Army contract as a trainer.
Mm-hmm.
And it got down to two airplanes, the Great Lakes and the Stearman. And as, of course, everyone knows, the Stearman won. Chose it because it was harder to land. The Great Lakes is easier to land and is more nimble. There goes the flying wing.
And yeah, it's nice to see that up in the air.
Yeah. No, that's the original stealth airplane that turns on knife edge and disappears from us. So the only difference between our plane and the original one from the 30s is that we've gone to a modern engine. So the engine's a flat Boxster Lycoming,
right?
As opposed to a radial. But okay. Other than that, it's a wooden fabric, open cockpit airplane.
Yeah, definitely looking forward to going for a ride in that.
Yeah, no, it'll be a good time.
And then you flew up here to the air show as well. What did you fly in?
So the biplane only goes so fast and only has a 26-gallon fuel tank, so it's not our favorite cross-country machine. So this morning I flew up in a Cherokee 6 that my wife and I own, and that's more of a traveling airplane. So came from Carlsbad and landed in San Bernardino, a little bit east of here, and picked up my father-in-law and then drove the half hour remaining in the journey to get here to the show.
Right. All the planes that they have here at the air show, which one would you like to fly the most?
Well, you know, it's kind of an unfair question. It's all of them.
Of course.
It's all of them. But the top of the list, I mean, the P-38, given that there's 7 left flying, and we've seen 2 in the air today, and that 7's in the whole world. So it's really special to see that, and to get to ride in that would probably be the hardest thing you could imagine.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be up there. Certainly the Corsair and the Mustang would be high on the list, but there's just so much great, so many great planes here. It's just an embarrassment of riches.
And it looks like C-47's getting ready to take off.
Yeah, that's... I'm not sure what... I think that's the one out of Riverside. They have several here today. And actually, this one I have flown in.
Oh, really?
I didn't fly it, but it's you can get rides in this one. I've ridden in that one, so...
Yeah, we're standing next to a beautiful silver, unpainted C-47.
Yeah, polished. I don't want to be the guy that has to polish that much aluminum.
Yeah, it sure is beautiful.
Yep.
Hey, so thank you so much for taking some time. Let's get back to watching some airplanes.
Excellent. Glad to meet up and glad to be on the show. Thanks.
Now it's time for our Airplane Geeks reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari. He talked with Tora 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 pilot Patrick Hutchins. Tora 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 is the commemorative Air Force's recreation of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. And it is intended as a memorial to all the soldiers on both sides who gave their lives for their countries.
Hello, Airplane Geeks listener. This is your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari. And today I'm with...
Patrick Hutchins with Tora Tora Tora.
And we're standing next to a Replica Zero.
Yes, it's a Replica Zero built by the movie company, 20th Century Fox, for the movie Tora Tora Tora. And what they used was a North American T-6 World War II trainer.
Talk me through the mods of what's different than this than our stock T-6.
Okay, well, the first thing, if you start up at the nose, they put a spinner on it. They put a fake cowl flaps on the cowling, some slits in the side sheet metal there. They added a gun deck in front of the front windshield.
Let's describe the gun deck is a raised about, what, 8 inches?
Yeah, about 8 inches, and it's got two 20-caliber machine guns, or I guess they were 30-caliber machine guns that would shoot through the propeller. And then we have a modified windshield. The entire canopy was modified, kind of teardropped, as opposed to the T-6, which is a straight-line canopy. And then they also put wing tips on to make it look like a Zero. So the wingspan of this airplane is about almost 4 feet wider than a normal T-6 wingspan. And then where the wing meets the fuselage, the wing root, they extended the wing root fairing about 3 feet to make it look like a Japanese Zero. And then there's a small stinger on the bottom of the rudder, because the bottom of the rudder of a Japanese Zero had a point on it.
So that stinger extends the rudder about, well, I don't know, eight inches?
About 8 inches, yeah. And then our back wheels retract, because to look like a Zero on the movie, that tail wheel needed to be up. Well, T-6 tail wheels do not retract. So they had to put a hydraulic cylinder in the tail, hook that into the hydraulic system. So these T-6s have 3 green lights when you know your gear down and locked, as opposed to just 2.
And you've got wheel pans?
Got wheel pans, yeah. Those wheel wheel fairings, we call them, are also another mod because Japanese Zeros had those, other than the bare wheels that you would see on a T-6.
Okay, so obviously the aircraft is an experimental aircraft.
It was experimental after they made all these modifications, and we've kept them that way all these years as opposed to making them a standard category aircraft. But with many advantages to them to be experimental, we can work on them ourselves a little bit more than you can a standard category.
Well, now, the Zero is a single-seater, and the canopy has been teardropped to make it look single-seater, but that may not be the case, right?
That's true. The guys that started flying these airplanes in 1972, after they started doing air shows with them, found ways to add back seats so they could take wives, girlfriends, friends, media, that kind of thing. We enjoy giving people rides in the airplanes when we get the opportunity.
Ooh, we're going to circle back to media after we're done with this.
Yep, that's a big thing. Sometime when we show up at an air show, the air show is arranged for either media or sponsors to take a ride. So we'll take a formation flight up, and it's a good experience for a lot of people. A lot of people have never been in formation in airplanes.
This is the Airplane Geeks. Let's get geeky about flying for a moment. You fly with pyro that's set up on the show line. So talk me through the show line, the flight line, the power, or the pyro line.
Okay, well, we have three lines of flights because we have Japanese Zeros, and we have Kate torpedo bombers, and we have Val dive bombers. And then when we have a fighter, a P-51 or a P-40, someone qualified to fly with us and we trust, we'll have a fighter on the 500-foot line, 500 feet from the crowd, 750 feet from the crowd, or where the Kates are flying back and forth, and then 1,000 feet from the crowd line are where the Zeros. So we have lateral separation for safety, but from the crowd, it looks like we're opposing each other within just feet or inches. We try and set a bottom altitude of 50 feet above the ground, and even when the pyro is directly underneath us, the guys that are shooting the pyro are watching out for us and trying not to shoot anything right in front of us. It has happened over the years accidentally. I've flown through fire myself. The engine just coughs, you get a little soot on the airplane, and you keep going. And it's really not a big deal, but we try not to do it because it's just not a good idea.
And is there any, you brief it during the show or during your pre-flights?
Oh, what's that, the pyro?
Yes.
Oh, no. No, we do this so often. We've been doing it for so many years with the same people in the pyro field. They know what they have to do. We know what we have to do. And we know what we have to do to protect each other. We're not flying 10 feet over the pyro because we respect their safety, and they're not shooting pyro right in front of us because they respect our safety. So no briefing is really required between us and pyro. When we're in orbit behind the crowd waiting for our turn to come in and do our performance, the air boss gives us a 5-minute call, and then we give them a 3-minute call, and that keys our narrator to start talking. 3 minutes after we give that call, we approach from over the top of the crowd and we break into the routine, which lasts about 8 minutes. And then we form up and come back for a wall of fire pass. And then we all individually make a photo pass and we land and taxi to the pits, and that's the show. It lasts 18 to 20 minutes.
Got it. And so flying with the pyro is no big deal for you guys.
No. In fact, when you are becoming a new Tora pilot, because, you know, guys come along, guys retire, we got to replace guys, you have to ride in the back seat of these airplanes 10 shows over pyro before you get to fly your first show. You may be qualified in the airplane, you may understand the routine, but as a rule, you have to ride in 10 shows over pyro before you get to fly your first show, just so you do acclimate yourself with the fire and the smoke and what's different about flying in perfectly clear air.
Now, how long have you been involved with Tora Tora Tora?
This is my 15th season with Tora Tora Tora. So I started in 2003. I grew up watching my father fly this airplane. I was, Tora Tora started in 1972, which is 46 years ago. And he joined them in 1976 when I was 16. And I thought it was really cool. I soloed on my 16th birthday, but I knew it'd be many years before I had the time off from work and the means to go to air shows almost every weekend. So I started flying. We did fly together for 8 years in air shows. And then in 2011, at 73 years old, he said, I'm done. That was 35 years of air shows for him in Tora Tora. And there's two other second-generation pilots here with us this weekend. Mike Burke next to me over here in 115, and Dan Reedy. His father actually was the very first Tora lead for the very first air show performance in 1972.
Wow. So you've been, you know, this is in your blood.
This has to be in your blood. It takes a lot of time, energy, maintenance on the airplane, but yes, in your blood is the exact phrase that sums it up.
Where are you guys next?
Next weekend we'll be at Dyess Air Force in Abilene. From there, we're off a weekend, then we go to Breckenridge, Texas. The very two weekends after that, we're taking all these airplanes all the way to Mountain Home Air Force Base in Idaho. Two weekends after that, we're at the Dayton Air Show in Dayton, Ohio. We'll also be at McConnell Air Force Base in Kansas. We're going to Terre Haute, Indiana. We'll be back in Texas for Houston. And we'll end up the season at the very last show, all the way back down at Homestead Air Force Base in Miami. So we get around.
All right. Well, thank you, sir. And if people want to know more about the Tora 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 show, where would they go?
We've got lots of great information about Tora and the history of Tora at ToraToraTora.com.
Well, thank you. This is your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari. Frequency change approved. Good day.
Thanks for that, Launchpad. Now, one more recording from him. At the 2017 Blue Bonnet Air Show in Texas, he spoke with Stephen Covington from SRC Air Shows about flying the pits cross-country to the next show.
Hello, airplane geeks. This is your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari, and I'm at the Blue Bonnet Air Show, and I've just pulled a guy out of a cockpit who's really cool. Introduce yourself, sir.
Stephen Covington with SRC Air Shows.
And he's just gone up and racked this airplane around. Tell us about this little airplane you're flying.
Airplane is a Pitts S2S, very highly modified one, aftermarket tail on it. G rating's been increased quite a bit on it. Biggest thing on it, it has a 400 horse Lycoming on it.
400 horsepower in an aircraft with a max gross takeoff weight of what, 50 pounds?
No. The plane weighs just a hair over 1,000 pounds before I get in it. So, you know, you're 1,400 pounds, you know, fully loaded, but it's light.
That's down in LSA, except for you have a 400 horsepower engine. We can't talk about the air show because that just won't translate on radio. But let me ask you, you're flying a 1,000-pound airplane with a 400 horsepower engine. How do you get to the air show with this airplane?
We have to fly it. I live in East Texas. This flight took me about an hour and a half. I had to make one stop for fuel. So it does take a little bit to get to air shows.
What I'm going for is, what's it like to fly cross-country in a highly modified, you know, acrobatic special aircraft?
It's not like jumping in your Bonanza or anything like that. It's a whole different world. There's no autopilot. You have to be on top of it all the time. It's always twitching around and bouncing around. You can get off heading a lot and stuff. So it really brings back your roots of flying. You really have to pay attention. So, you know, you got to be on top of your game, and it's stressful. You know, it's a lot of work to get across country in it.
And of course, it's VFR only.
It is VFR only, yes.
Now, what instrumentation do you have inside that helps you?
It does have a glass panel in it, so I do have a full avionics glass panel, but I have iFly GPS sponsors the airplane, and I do have a full GPS in it. Gives me live traffic, ADS-B in and out on the plane. It is already 2020 compliant, thanks to them. that's how I get around. Even has on fuel prices. I can check my fuel while I'm in the air to see where I want to stop to get the cheapest gas, even since I'm stopping a whole lot to get places.
Okay, let's talk about that for a second. You know, what's the range on a show airplane? Or, I mean, on an acrobatic demonstration aircraft?
You can, I mean, you can go 180, 200 miles, but I hate to ever push it. One kind of cool thing about this plane, which is a feature I don't use very often, but it does have it, is I can convert my smoke tank, which is 16 more gallons, into a fuel tank. And it has some valves and stuff, and you got to flush out the smoke oil, convert it over to gas, and it'll give me 2 hours of flight time that way. So that makes it to where I can actually get somewhere, because doing 180 knots, you can get somewhere, you know, in 2 hours. It's just a lot of work to do it, though, so it's very rare that I ever do that. I just would rather make the gas stop, because, you know, it does climb fast and does descend fast, so you're not wasting a ton of time to get gas. But if you were going to fly to the East Coast or the West Coast from where I'm at, it would be something that you would want to do. It's just once you get to where you're going, you have to flush all the gas out to get it all back over to run smoke again. So it's a little bit of a process.
Okay, I want to go back to, you've got this great iFly GPS. Now, does that stay in the aircraft when you're doing your performances?
It does. It does sit in the airplane. They do not know the G rating on it yet. They figured it would hold up to what I do, so I'm kind of a test pilot for that. It's held up so far great. It has a touch screen on it. It's a very handy little unit. I can do anything on it, from weather to traffic to my normal GPS. You can see it in the sunlight beaming through the cowling, so it is a very, very, very nice unit. Another big positive that I like about the iFly is I actually have a memory card in it, and I have all my MP3s in it, and it plays it right in my headset. So I have a radio in my airplane, too, to listen to music. So while I'm going cross-country, I don't get bored.
Very cool. So you fly, you know, you have to transport the aircraft yourself, or do you have a fleet of ferry pilots at your beck and call?
That would be nice, but I trust very few people in that airplane, so I fly it everywhere.
When our fans want to go check out more about your aircraft, tell us where we'd go.
You can look me up on Facebook, SRC Air Shows. My website is srcairshows.com, or you can just Google me and you'll find all of our stuff that way. A lot of videos online. There's videos on YouTube, a lot of stuff on my Facebook page, and all my events and upcoming stuff and my promo videos are all on my website.
Well, thank you, sir. This is Launchpad Marzari, frequency change approved. Good day.
Next up, we have an Across the Pond segment. Here, Peter Johnson talks with Neil Braden. Peter interviewed Neil several times for the Airplane Geeks while Neil was doing his private license training in the U.S. Well, Neil's back in Europe. We wonder, is he able to continue flying? If not, what does Neil do to keep his aviation drive going? Well, Peter finds out.
With the Airplane Geeks 500 episode just behind us, there was only one guest I could bring back to my monthly segment, and that's Neil Braden, our adopted pilot from across the pond many, many years ago. Or it seems that way. It was about 3 or 4 years ago. Neil, welcome back across the pond.
Hello, Peter. I'm delighted to be back on again. 500 episodes, what a great milestone for the Airplane Geeks. Congratulations. If I look back at my journey through podcasts, you know, I started out several years ago with the Airplane Geeks along with the UCAP gang, and it's great to see both podcasts still going. Long may it continue.
Yeah, they've done a fantastic job, which is better than I've done, but I'm back in the seat now, so be gentle with me, Neil. Neil, we talked a few years ago, and you'd qualified in the US, you'd come back to Europe, you'd done a little bit of flying, but what's happened in the last few years?
So as a reminder, I returned from America. The American dream ended in May 2014, so almost 4 years ago. And I returned to Ireland after building over 220 hours on my private pilot license, landing at over 50 airports, 5 different states, including 7 intentional water landings up near Seattle. On returning, my life took a different path. As soon as I returned, with family work commitments taking priority, it may sound familiar to many of the listeners. Before I knew it, My currency and medical lapsed, and here today I find myself grounded, nearing needing a medical and a flight with you. I did reignite my passion again for flying with a week-long visit to Sun and Fun and the Aviation Geek Fest in Seattle in 2016. However, I have no immediate plans to return to the skies as pilot in command over the next couple of years, but I do continue to live off the great memories from my time living in Arizona and Oregon. As you agree, social media and podcasting has been a great platform for allowing many of us to share our passions.
Such a shame that so many of us have gone that way, I before you. So I feel for you. But it's more tricky over here, isn't it? It's not quite so easy as it was in the States. And I know a lot's changed there as well, but it's just so restrictive here. If nothing else, the weather.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's becoming that way. And that's why I'm living off the great memories I've had built up over the years with the hope that one day I will get back into it again.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I know you're a very keen flight simmer. I don't know if that's the right description for you, but I see an awful lot on social media and looks like some really interesting stuff. What's going on? What attracts you to the flight sim arena?
So growing up in the 80s in England, I had no idea that getting a pilot's license was an option. Neither my family nor friends showed any interest in aviation. I developed a passion for air traffic control at a very, very young age. And in 1984, my father purchased a family Commodore 64, and I saved up my pocket money and bought Solo Flight 64 and then Kennedy Approach. And that was my introduction to flight simulators and further fueled my passion for ATC. Back then, flight simulator options were limited. And if you fast forward to 2018, the flight sim community continues to grow. Simulators available on various platforms ranging from a phone, a tablet, all the way up to a high-end personal computer costing several thousands of dollars. The majority of the listeners will be familiar with the Microsoft Flight Simulator platform, but this is no longer the simulator of choice. X-Plane, who over the years has been renowned for their aircraft modeling, is now on version 11. Lockheed Martin took the Microsoft engine and developed a sim called Prepared, commonly known as P3D. Both these sims have converted from 32 to 64-bit platforms, requiring more powerful PCs to run. There's online ATC networks and third-party study-level aircraft, means you can replicate real-world flying operations as per the airlines, or low and slow in any G aircraft taking in the eye candy. For the military enthusiast, Digital Combat Simulator is available for free of charge, and the option to purchase study-level military aircraft, such as the AV-8 Harrier, and soon-to-be-released FA-18C. In summary, flight simulators in 2018 are only limited to what is in your imagination, and that is why I fly them.
Now, you also just wanted to ask you there, Neil, you did some charity work on flight sims. What was that all about?
Yeah, that was the Flight 48 Hour Challenge, where there's these various fixed-base 737 simulators all around the UK, and there's one just north of Manchester, and there was a guy there who was going to stay awake for 48 hours. And he raised in excess of £1,000 for a local air ambulance charity. And I was basically part of their social media team promoting the event.
Any plans to fly in the coming months? So if you're not going to be pilot in command, what's the flying agenda like for Neil?
Yeah, I've got quite a busy summer. So my summer of aviation will kick off in July, when I will be unloading and loading passengers at a charity event at my local GA airport just southwest of Dublin. For one day, there's some local pilots from the region give up their time and aircraft to provide flights for local children and young adults to experience flying in an aircraft for a small time. I won't be flying myself, but it's great to see so many families get some small enjoyment out of aviation here in Ireland. I do have two air shows planned, one in Dublin and one in Northern Ireland, that will be happening over the summer. I'll be looking forward to seeing the Royal Air Force Red Arrows 2018 routine. And in addition to that, I hope to be catching the Blades aerobatic team, the Battle of Britain Memorial flight, and the Typhoon display team at one or both of these events. And actually, it's almost 4 years since I returned to Ireland from the US. I still have not seen Lauren Wilson fly a display in her pits too. I'm really hoping to be able to catch an air show in the UK at some point over the summer. In addition to that, I'm actually going to go back to the US in August for a week's vacation with the family. We never got to visit Washington, D.C. whilst we were over there, so we're going to go over there for a week. And obviously, there's some fantastic aviation museums to be visited while I'm there.
Yeah.
And in addition, I hope to go and rent a Cessna 172 with a CFI for a couple of hours. And then to round off my summer, I'll be visiting Vanguard House, which is located near London Heathrow, where a group of like-minded aviation geeks will be flying the British Airways full motion simulators for an evening, doing our best not to break them. This will be the second time attending this event. Last year I flew the 747-400, and this year it will be the 74 or 777. Sadly, the 787 simulator is not yet available to the public. It's not the cheapest aviation event I've ever attended, but it's highly addictable.
Neil, I'm so glad that although you're no longer pilot in command, you've still got the passion to follow all those dreams. Neil, where can we find you online?
So listeners can still find me on Twitter under the handle @pilot_NGB. That is November Golf Bravo.
Okay, Neil, good luck this summer. Hope all goes well for you. Thanks so much for joining me again.
And thanks for having me on, Peter. Goodbye.
Thanks, Peter. Again, you can find Neil on Twitter @pilot_NGB. We received some great feedback from one of our listeners, which contained a good positive commercial airline story. Brian takes us through it.
Well, it's been a few episodes since we've had a positive airline story of the week, and this one is brought to us by a listener. It comes in the form of an email, so I'll read it to you because I thought it was so good. It starts, "Hi, everybody. I'm a big fan of the Airplane Geeks podcast. You do some terrific stuff, and I mostly enjoy the episodes. However, I have to say, I do truly wince at times when particularly negative things are said for the whole world to hear, and I'm not naive nor excessively optimistic, but I would like to offer an alternative view on one of those issues. Specifically today, I want to share with you a good airline story and a few thoughts on airline employees. Thank you, Brian, for your endeavors to give attention to good airline stories. United Airlines Flight Attendant Saves Mom's Breast Milk is a positive airline story that was submitted. We'll have a link to it in the show notes. The story is from today.com, and it reads, "A flight attendant shocked this mom with an unexpected act of kindness." I'll paraphrase the story. Rachel Braverman was traveling with her family. She was breastfeeding and pumping her breast milk. She had it in a container on the flight and left it, unfortunately, in the seat in front of her. A United flight attendant said the passenger on the next flight going from Newark to Miami showed him the bag left under the seat. Knowing how precious pumped breast milk is, the flight attendant asked the captain to turn back to the gate. When that wasn't possible, the flight attendant put the bag on ice and then, after landing in Miami, got his agents to look up the passenger manifest from the previous flight and tried to contact the Bravermans. When they couldn't reach the family, he asked for their number so he could call them himself because he was headed back to Newark that evening. Rachel was dumbfounded that the flight attendant reached out. She was even more stunned when the flight attendant said upon his return to Newark, he would drop off the breast milk at their house in northern New Jersey. She texted him, "Are you sure?" His reply was, "It's Mother's Day. Don't even worry about it. I'm just happy to help." And after the flight landed at 11:30 p.m., he stopped by the Braverman's home with the milk. Rachel asked for his name and United number in order to tell the airline how much she appreciated what he does. Quote, "It was so nice and such a kind human behavior," she said. "Who does that? He never even met me. He wasn't on my flight. He was on the crew that came after me." So as this story points out, there really are exceptional individuals, not only at United, but every airline, that really go above and beyond. These stories certainly don't get reported enough. But enough about my personal comments. Let's get back to what the listener wrote in their email. "Guys, I can't tell you how much it pains me to hear the many negative comments on Airplane Geeks about airlines, especially a certain airline, and how they treat their customers. There is no denying that corporate culture has a huge impact on the air travel experience, but airlines are made up of thousands of individuals, and I have good reason to believe that the vast majority of those individual employees sincerely want the passengers to be happy. Many of those thousands of airlines employees go above and beyond every single day to foster a good passenger experience, despite the limited resources they are given to deal with the myriad of situations that arise. Though it typically does not make the news, it's certainly true that there are a large number of passengers who are delighted with the many big and small efforts that the airline employees make on their behalf every day. It is an unfortunate reality that in the commodity-priced, high-pressure, time-sensitive world of airline operations, Especially at big hubs, airline employees are often severely time-stressed. The pursuit of on-time metrics unfortunately drive practically everything nowadays, as these metrics are used to measure success. Additionally, there is no denying that airlines now run at minimum staffing as well as maximum resource utilization. No extra airplanes, no extra gates, no extra employees. And that usually leaves almost no margin to deal with challenging situations that arise from weather, equipment malfunctions, ATC delays, and other negative events. Of course, all this leads to less than stellar days out at the airports. It's also admittedly true that there have been too many self-inflicted stumbles, fumbles, and customer relation nightmares. However, there are indeed innumerable good stories like this one about a thoughtful flight attendant going a lot of extra miles. There are so many other stories of employees doing amazing things for passengers, even more touching than this one, that are never known to the world. It's just a sad reality that these kinds of good stories usually go untold and are virtually unnoticed even when they are published. Bad news sells better and certainly gets more clicks. Also, the typical person who does a good deed will not tell anyone they did it. It is only if the recipient of the good deed decides to share that we have a chance of hearing about it. It is quite easy to understand why these feel-good stories are seldom heard above the din of raucous, target-rich environment of the crowded, stressful airline travel experience. I'd like to encourage the view that there is usually more to the story, almost any story. By recognizing positive behavior in others, we often, in turn, experience even more positive behavior from some of that golden rule stuff. Perhaps we can all try harder to catch people doing good things rather than focusing on the less than good things. That goes for every part of our lives, not just the stress-laden part that lurks at the airport. Disclaimer: I am an airline pilot, and I see personally many instances of airline employees doing good and sometimes amazing things for passengers. I can't begin to tell you how many above and beyond things I have witnessed. Most of us will do whatever we can to help our passengers solve problems that arise and to help them enjoy the time they spend with us. I believe that we can all do a part to represent not only our employees in a good way, but also to be ambassadors for doing the right thing, just because it's the right thing. Yes, I am fully aware that civility, common decency, and personal space seem to be in short supply in the high-stress world of airline travel, but please be assured that there are thousands of airline employees putting a lot of effort into making it a better experience. For obvious reasons, my airline will be unnamed and I cannot speak on behalf of my company. Please keep up the outstanding work you do. You are powerful ambassadors for aviation around the world, and you are appreciated. Kind regards. Well, thank you so much for sending in that letter. It really does show, and a point that I've tried to make several times, that there really are individuals that do a fantastic job and go above and beyond every single day. It is unfortunate that there are some employees that, well, are really the bad apples and or are having a bad day and or are just not doing the right thing. And unfortunately, we have to report those as well. And yes, you're right. It is easier talking about the negative rather than focusing on the positive, and that's really why I wanted to start the positive commercial airline story of the week. I really did want to take a moment to point out the really, truly spectacular things that certain individuals do that make that miracle flight so positive and fun and enjoyable. Thank you so much, and continue to write in. We appreciate it.
A lot of good things in that email. Having worked in a corporate environment, my observation has been that an organization can have a dual personality. There are the individuals that make up the organization. Their values and behaviors can collectively define the company, but the company can also have its own identity, its own values, its own personality. Except during a period, perhaps, when the organization is attempting to make an internal cultural change, these personalities should be aligned. When they are not, well, the customer tends to suffer. Okay, end of soapbox. Finally, student pilot Nikki provides segment 11 of her journey to becoming a pilot. Here's Nikki.
Hello, Airplane Geeks. Nikki here again. Hey, this is a quick follow-up to my last recording when I landed on the runway 31 at St. Augustine. Believe it or not, I finished my full cross-country going to two different airports. I did go to St. Augustine again, and then I went to Craig and back. When I landed in St. Augustine this time, the tower did actually instruct me to turn left on runway 20 and hold shoulder Bravo. I was prepared for it this time because it happened to me on last time, but this time they actually did physically instruct me to turn left on runway 20 and hold short of Bravo. But I don't want to bore you with the details of that particular landing. I have a little story about actually returning home and the fun of flying at an uncontrolled airport. My overall flight went very well. I was off my timing by probably less than a minute, which I thought was really cool. My fuel consumption was pretty much dead on and everything. The overall flight went very well, going to both airports, besides me being extremely nervous. Overall, again, very well. But on the way back to my home airport, it's kind of like the Wild Wild West sometimes. We have a very large jump school at our airport, so our particular airport has rules. You don't overfly our airport and stuff like that. In fact, if you ever read about our airport or anything, there's always a NOTAM saying do not overfly the airport. So I am fully aware of this. I know that all of our patterns are left-hand patterns and stuff like that. I'm local to the airport. I know it. So when coming into the airport, probably about 12 miles out, I key up my mic and I'm listening and I hear someone landing on runway 23. And I'm like, I can barely understand this guy. His radio is total garbage, if it even works. All I hear is runway 23. I don't hear him say he's landing, if he's taking off, or what he's doing, or anything else he's doing. I honestly can barely make it out. And as I'm listening more and more, I key up the mic, and hopefully I know the jump plane is in the area. He'll hear me ask for a traffic advisory. He's probably monitoring everything. He's taking off and landing. They typically use a parallel runway, which our airport has two runways. It has runway 0523, which is our main runway that I use most of the time, and then runway 12 parallel 30. So typically the jump plane always uses the parallel one. So when I heard this guy saying 23, I was like, okay, jump plane will probably be using the other runway, not a big deal. So when I key up the mic, the jump plane doesn't say anything, and I hear someone coming up on the radio saying, oh, taking off 05. And I immediately paused for a second and said, wait a minute, isn't this other guy landing on 23? You're taking off on 05. I said, there's a problem here somewhere. So the other guy that has the horrible radio comes back saying, landing 23. That's all we make out. Then a jump plane comes up saying, landing on 12, holding short of runway 23. And I'm like, okay. And the other guy now says, holding short of 05. And I'm like, you know, if we had someone lined up on 30, we'd have a plan on every end of every runway we had. So I had to key up the mic again and say, what is the active runway? I assumed 12 was the jump plane because he is a twin engine otter. And I know pretty much all of the jump plane pilots by now. And the guy came up saying, runway 23, I'm landing on runway 23. And again, this is what we assume he said. All we hear is like what the number, and we don't actually understand what he's saying. So finally, the pilot that's holding short on 05 says, winds are favoring 05, the other guy's radio sucks, and he needs to land to fix it. And the other pilot comes back saying, you don't hear me? Or technically, we assume that because we have no idea what he said. The guy holding short of 05 says, nope, have no clue what you're saying, don't understand anything. So I come back and I said, oh, okay, Roger, 05 is going to be the active runway, once plane coming in on 23. I'll come in for the 45 for runway 05. And of course, I knew the jump plane was landing on 12, but I very rarely worry about him. But I knew where he was, I saw him. And the guy on 05, when I got closer, I saw him lining up on 05. The guy on 23, I think he was flying a Piper Cub. I have no idea, but I assume his radio was not working because all you heard was pretty much static, 23, static, and that was it. I'm hoping by now he's got his radio fixed. I thought you guys would get a kick out of that little experience flying into an uncontrolled airport and having people almost on every runway taking off or landing. This is Nikki saying goodnight.
Well, that's it for this Bits and Pieces episode. We hope you enjoyed it. Next time, we'll return to our usual format with aviation news from the past week, a great guest, and a lot more. Don't forget to visit the aviation events calendar at avgeekfests.com and load in some of the events in your area that would be of interest to other avgeeks, and feel free to share the avgeekfests.com link across your network. Find us at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/505. Our outro is by Bruno Massone. You can find more of his compositions that incorporate aviation sounds with other music at brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody. We'll be right back.